Now we come to the 16th of July, 1920. Rudolf Steiner starts by indicating that he said, I'd like to precede the following three lectures by today an introduction, which should orient us in the first place from a certain point of view about the relationship of the anthroposophically orientated spiritual scientific movement to the more older spiritual scientific movements. No, to the more older spiritual research movement, Geistesforschung, the more older spiritual research movements. You've indeed noticed, and I've often mentioned it and characterized how it was necessary through the relationships of time that that knowledge of the supersensible world from which we of which we speak within our spiritual scientific movement, that is necessary to handle that knowledge differently from the knowledge which one handles, which was brought in as knowledge to human beings in the ancient mysteries. You also know that the comparison of this spiritual scientific knowledge of the present time with the initiation knowledge of the ancient mystery is justified to compare them in spite of their differences. To be sure, the ancient mystery beingness was so configured that it mediated knowledge which absolutely, one might say, rested upon an atavistic, half-dreamy configured condition of consciousness. That modern consciousness of which we speak here is so configured that everything in it, right to the smallest details, must be reached with complete consciousness, with such a consciousness which is completely equivalent to the consciousness which we have when we take into ourselves and work over geometrical, mathematical truths which can be completely surveyed. Thus, the completely awakened spirit life will, through the completely awakened spiritual experience, through this modern spiritual movement, achieves in a soul life which has to be completely illuminated by that light which also illuminates our waking day life when we are really awake. Now, this instinctive, half-dreamy knowledge of the ancient mysteries were supposed to lead to the higher, supersensible forms of existence. We have often spoken of the special character of this ancient mystery knowledge. We have pointed to the fact that it goes back to a certain primal knowledge, to a certain primal wisdom of mankind. But the prejudices of modern materialistic Darwin conceptions covers over the fact that mankind did not proceed in its development from animal-like conditions, but proceeded from conditions in which there is no analogy in the present physical world, conditions in which life of the soul was so closed in itself that even over the whole earth, which was populated at that time, there was present a knowledge of the spiritual which was instinctively acquired. We must, to be sure, take note of the fact that when we hold this fact of the supersensible knowledge before our eyes, that mankind in that primeval time lived in a much more naive, elementary, one might say innocent, life configuration than in present-day mankind, that mankind of those primeval times, in a certain sense, there was deposited in primeval mankind those drives which were placed in mankind by the divine spiritual beings themselves. So that one can say the following, on that domain which we today are able to designate as the moral domain, the human beings of the people of the primeval time were beings who simply presented themselves as instruments or tools for the deeds of divine spiritual being, so that one could not be able to speak of that time as people having their own responsibility. But at that time, you couldn't speak of a personal sinning of the individual. Also, you couldn't speak of a deviation from the will of those divine spiritual beings out of which actually the human soul capacity proceeded. And from there you can see the reasons why in that ancient time it was possible to spread out among human beings a knowledge of the supersensible things. This supersensible knowledge of that time, even in the atavistic conditions of the primeval period, that knowledge which they had, that supersensible knowledge, was actually connected with the domination of certain, with the domination, with the power over certain forces of material existence. Today we're very proud about the fact that out of a few natural scientific ideas, we've been able to build up our modern technology. That in a certain degree, through our knowledge of nature, we are able to dominate and hold the power of the nature which is in front of us. However, in a quite different way, to be sure, the human beings of the primeval age, in virtue of the knowledge which they had in their innocent soul configuration, they were able to dominate the different nature forces. And because of their characteristic soul constitution, the knowledge which was given to them by the spiritual beings could not be used to the damaging of mankind. You know out of my presentations that this primal mankind was not so condensed in a thick material way as later mankind and as the present mankind, which that they, in a certain connection, this primeval mankind, were less materialized than we are today. And that was connected with the fact that the impulses of the divine spiritual beings could express themselves in a much more direct way than was possible later on. That which gradually occurred in the evolution of mankind is indeed a uniting of the soul spiritual aspect with the physical material aspect. As it were, man descended deeper and deeper into materiality. But precisely with this descent into materiality, there occurred what one might call the possibility of sinning, the possibility of deviating from the paths which came out of the impulses of the divine spiritual beings. Thus, there developed gradually the possibility of doing evil, and also the possibility of applying supersensible knowledge in an evil sense. This possibility inserted itself at a certain point of time in human evolution. And at this certain point of time, something very special occurred. That the knowledge which once was spread over the whole masses of people at a certain point of time began to be concentrated within the mystery places, within the oracles. And you can learn this if you study my book, Occult Science. There, as it were, from the broad mass of mankind, there was withdrawn that knowledge of the supersensible worlds. And this became the possession of people who had been initiated into the mysteries. So that the evolution proceeds, that actually more and more the supersensible knowledge disappears out of the great masses of mankind, and it is preserved in its actual form in the mysteries. These mysteries continued themselves more or less right to the approach of the Christian times, and some of them still continued to exist in a few centuries after the Christian times. But various mysteries which contain the deepest knowledge For example, actually in the region of present France, were in the century before the arising of Christianity, was completely extinguished by the Romans in a frightfully bloody way. And in places like this, to which one can point, there flowed into, in the last pre-Christian centuries within Europe, a wonderful penetrating knowledge, a knowledge which subsequently for Europe completely disappeared. So also it occurred in other places in Europe. And subsequently, only in very, very narrow circles could this primal cosmic wisdom be preserved. Now in these circles, in which very, very seldom was it possible to find in these circles people who out of their own perception could rise up into the supersensible worlds, in these circles it was also possible to apply in different directions the knowledge of the supersensible worlds, to do it in a rather damaging, folk egoistical way. Reaching up to the present day, as I have characterized to you in other lectures, when I talked about the work of certain secret societies of the English-speaking peoples. Many secret societies with more or less justifiable aspects, or sometimes in a very doubtful way, tried to preserve this knowledge and often withdrew this knowledge from people in the lower grades. They claimed that these people in the lower grades of their secret societies were not ripe enough, mature enough, to get certain contents of knowledge. I'm telling you all these things to act as an introduction for which, for when I'm going to tell you much more important things tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. Must, in reference to the spreading of the knowledge of the supersensible world, we must stand upon that standpoint of being a more in a democratic way. And as you know, I haven't held back from imparting very important supersensible knowledge to the widest publicity, at least up to a certain stage. Even I presented in public lectures, even though it was so little understood. And many people who belonged to certain mysteries or secret societies were very much upset at me saying these things in public, things which one should not publicly convey to people. I did it because I felt it was necessary that certain knowledges should be given over into publicity, into much more public, because, as I emphasize time and time again, this knowledge must flow as social impulses into present mankind and mankind of the new future. So I continued in my public lectures to impart this knowledge. Precisely the most important things which I've inserted now in my public lectures. These were have actually worked in a very shattering way. One got the impression, even though I've imparted these things, the souls who received them simply took it in a quite healthy sleep. You talk to their ears and they go to sleep. Nevertheless, in spite of all these things, we have to impart these things publicly. And I've attempted to do this in a form, again and again, within our anthroposophical society, right even to a very high grade, even though I didn't make very good experiences with it. Now, it might be laughable to consider the fact that one might present higher geometry to people who do not know the fundamentals of elementary geometry. Well, this comparison is not really applicable, because that which as a certain higher knowledge one presents out of the domain of anthroposophical oriented spiritual science, that does not completely relate itself to the elementary aspects as higher geometry relates itself to elementary geometry. The situation more appropriately is like this. A person who knows no elementary geometry, the situation will be that when you present to him the higher geometry, he will push it back because he is very clear about the fact that he doesn't understand it. However, in the case of a person who doesn't understand the preliminary knowledge of anthroposophy, you can present to him the higher knowledge of anthroposophy, and he can take it. He understands it just as little as other people understand higher geometry. But there, knowledge must be clothed in a popular way, and because this knowledge is clothed in a popular way when you convey it to him, he believes that he can understand it. The person to whom you present higher geometry realizes he can't understand it. And then what happens? You get people like the priest named Cooley, and this priest takes the higher knowledge and puts it in a distorted form, and in that distorted form, caricatured form, he brings it to mankind. But when you bring true knowledge to people in a untruthful, distorted form, that contributes to the destruction of mankind. That's why I've often emphasized that this higher knowledge should not be presented to people until you present them first the lower knowledge. And with that, in our anthroposophical society, we've made very bad experiences. People accused us of trying to act in the way in which these old mystery schools acted. So when I attempted to restrict the knowledge in recent times, then I was subject to all sorts of false interpretations. This higher knowledge that we've imparted must be carefully understood, and you can't just play with it. There's a duty towards the spiritual world. There's a duty towards the leading guides of mankind. This must be considered as to be a much higher duty as compared with what is characterized in the outside world and their criticisms of us. Nevertheless, the time has arrived when a certain totality of supersensible knowledge in an unconditional way must be supplied to the world. We must do our best to prevent this knowledge being misused by people. Nevertheless, we have to do our best to impart it to people. Now, in this connection with what I've just told you, I want you to bear in mind the following facts. Supersensible knowledge, as a general rule, is not dangerous if you speak in an abstract way about the spiritual. For the seriousness becomes immediately a necessity when it deals with the supersensible knowledge of the more ancient initiates. Such things indeed are only quite surveyable for those people who are able to find again the wisdom of the ancient initiates out of their own researches. The ancient initiate said the following: if one imparts occult truths according to the number three, one can, as a general rule, cause all sorts of social damages. You're able to fedum the human beings. You can send the human beings to sleep. You can cloud their consciousness over, and so on. But when one imparts the mysteries of the supersensible worlds in a sevenfold form, then you are imparting to human beings something which, if they are inclined to be evil, will lead towards evil. Thus, the initiate said the following: in the threefold way to impart supersensible knowledge will, under circumstances, cause external social damage. To impart things in the sevenfold way, that signifies a danger in the moment where these holy mysteries of mankind are imparted to people who can find a direction towards evil. Now, what does this mean? You see, there exists a certain harmless mysticism. Such a harmless mysticism is pursued if one gets together in a sectarian way, in small circles, And then you tell them all sorts of things about the ether body, about the astral body, about reincarnation, about karma, and so on. In short, when you speak in abstract sentences about these things, just as you speak about things in ordinary life, without converting yourself into a different soul constitution than ordinary life. It really doesn't do very much damage. It's perfectly harmless, as a matter of fact, although it would be much more wise if these people, instead of doing that, were to do their washing or knitting or things like that. You know very well that we, upon our anthroposophical ground, never entered into such abstract stuff. We have always emphasized the fact that in reference to certain content-filled knowledge about the human being and about the nature of the cosmic, we have often emphasized the fact of special conceptions and ideas to be made about the supersensible in such a way that all these ideas of our anthroposophical-oriented spiritual science were able to pour itself in to real life, into the life of, into the medical life, into the social life, into the natural scientific life. We've emphasized time and time again that particularly when you talk about the introduction of a social health into our catastrophical conditions, it's only possible to do that by carrying in supersensible knowledge. When such supersensible knowledge is carried into the realm of medicine, then there begins immediately that particular domain of which the real initiates knows that this can cause evil in the hands of evil people. Supersensible knowledge is necessary to be poured into the social situation, otherwise you get catastrophe. But that supersensible knowledge which we've poured into the medical field, that can be used in an evil way. Since when we strengthen our soul forces of thinking, feeling, and willing, as we in the first place carry them in our soul as in an abstract way, when we strengthen these soul forces of thinking, feeling, and willing, then these soul forces are very, very strong, mere image applied as images upon the ordinary consciousness, very shadowed pictures. Here's one of those typical Steinerian sentences, so involved, if read it again and again and again to get bloody sense out of it. And I'll try again. I'll change the form of it. In the first place, we carry in our soul abstractions. Our soul forces of thinking, feeling, and willing are abstractions. But when we strengthen them, then these soul forces are still very, very strong, pure images. Images which the ordinary consciousness has produced, shadowed images, okay? In them, there is only a small intensity of reality. That which human beings are able to think, that is, I might say, image of image, build from build, image of an image. What they're able to feel certainly is still an image. And in the will, they do not descend down. There you see only pictures of external events which occur as a consequence of this will upon the physical plane. And everything which you there experience, since it's so little connected with reality, that can't do much damage. You're entering into the region of abstract concepts. And now Rudolf Sutter comes to tell you what he's really talking about. He says, you can speak very beautifully about Atma, Buddhi, Manas, etc., but then you're actually speaking of abstract words. Words are very far removed from reality and are very little connected with reality. Rudolf Steiner draws a triangle on the board, and that triangle refers to the ordinary forces of the ordinary abstract ideas or experience in our soul of our thinking, feeling, and willing, the ordinary upper head ideas. trinity of thinking, feeling and winning, all the upper carrying ideas that are only there. All this, you can't do very much damage. It's all abstract. When you come to the threefoldness, the trinity aspect, it's all abstract. However, now comes a point. With our instincts, with all that which lies at the basis of our temperament, that which is at the basis of our instinctive nature, there we are standing much more in reality. If, for example, we have our hunger, out of our hunger you get the flowing out of our will instincts. Then when we feel hungry, we're really standing strongly in reality. And if we didn't exist such a thing as hunger, and with all that which is connected with hunger, then we wouldn't have those perverse instincts of will. You wouldn't get things like the Russian Bolshevism. With this square, this four-cornered square, we do live in reality. But out of this four-cornered square of reality, there you go above that and you get the shadow of the triangle, and there you have the shadow of our thinking, feeling and willing. The thinking, feeling, willing in our head in the threefoldness is a shadow lifting itself up out of the square with our instincts, drives, temperaments, with which reality is much more connected. Just as our soul life is three-membered, so is this reality four-membered. The reality of our instincts, drives, and temperaments is four-membered, and was always presented like that by the initiates. So when you consider the whole man, you have a seven-membered human being. But with the lower members, that which in which man in a certain way repeats the animal aspect, you have a much more intensive reality character in front of you than the shadow distilled abstraction of thinking, feeling and willing. Now, however, the knowledge of the supersensible worlds takes hold of if only consciousness takes hold of it in an abstract way. Nevertheless, in our instinct life, in our temperament, in our life of drives, the world takes hold of reality. In our realm of consciousness, abstract. In the realm of our temperament drives, reality. With this triangle, which represents the world of the soul element, as man has it today, this triangle, you can have three thin lines of a triangle. So you have to make a diagram of the square representing the life of instinct, drives, and temperaments. You have to have this square, the lines of this square, very thick. And it's into this world of the instinctive, the drive and the temperaments that supersensible knowledge plays itself into. But this world has to be ennobled, otherwise it'll become the evil world. Thus, supersensible knowledge should work upon this world only in such a way that it is able to ennoble this world. So in the moment where one enters in realities with supersensible knowledge, where man dives down into the material element, it absolutely depends upon the fact as to whether that occurs in a purely ethical, free type of mood, or whether it occurs in an impure, immoral, unfree, which means emotional, instinctive, animal mood. Now all these things which I try to explain to you, all this was perceived and known by those protectors of the human primal cosmic wisdom, which had enclosed away the higher knowledge in the mysteries, and only permitted those who prepared to receive it to get this higher knowledge. However, this abschließen, this preservation, this protection, this restriction is not something which one can maintain today, is an absolute necessity. And those people today are completely incorrect. Those people today who belong, for example, to certain secret societies and want to maintain in an abstract sense the complete necessity for silence about this higher knowledge, they are absolutely incorrect. They are incorrect because these people do not understand the signs of the times. They preserve the old traditions. They still say today that which the great teachers of mystery wisdom said thousands of years ago. It's very interesting, for example, that in the books of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, precisely there, where Blavatsky speaks in the most ingenious way about occult things, you will find there soul moods about the necessity for silence about occult knowledge. Soul moods which are not valid today, but which Blavatsky had to manifest because she had learned those from those people who have no idea, not the slightest inkling, of what are the necessities of our present age. And so Blavatsky handled like a personality who also could have lived thousands of years ago. She hadn't the slightest inkling of the life necessities of the present time. And so she spoke about the necessity of keeping quiet about certain mystery truths, just as the mystery priests of thousands of years ago spoke about the necessity to keep quiet. But through that, even though you don't want to become untruth, you become untrue in reference to your fellow human beings. And certain supersensible streams become precisely from this viewpoint to the highest degree untrue in reference to the fellow human beings of the present time. Because the times in which we live today speak a clear and significant language. And this language announces itself on soul spiritual domains of an extraordinary deviation among human beings. The soul spiritual domains, there exists among human beings a very extraordinary aberrations. And here Rudolf Steiner is referring to the work of Oswald Spengler. I have recently brought your attention, to be sure, upon a literary phenomenon, upon the book The Decline of the West by Oswald Spengler. I have told you that this book had a very deep influence on youth, particularly upon the students of Central Europe. And that recently, when I spoke before the students of the Stuttgart Technical High School about the significance and the nature of the spiritual scientific anthroposophical research, I received a very full impression of the fact that these Spengler ideas about the decline of the West had made a very important impact upon the academic youth. And this book of Spengler's about the decline of the West had a deep effect not only in Europe, but even right to England. And in the English paper, The Times, notice was taken about, and they gave a lot of reviews about this particular book. The question is, what do we find in this Spengler book as a remarkable theory? We find in a thick book written by a person who, as I told you, was able to be very well at home in 12 to 15 sciences, he offered the proof according to the pattern. There we find demonstrated that the whole West, with its American attachment, has become old. Civilization stands old, as would have, it stands before death in the beginning of the third millennium. That actually a barbarism will have to break in approximately around the year 2200. And that which is present Western civilization will be succeeded by a barbarism. Find this expressed with all the ability of present science and proven that way. The book speaks about all the influences which point to the decay of Western civilization to the year 2200, when it will be succeeded by barbarism. But this is unaware of another fact which is present in human nature, and which spiritual scientific deepening tries to point out, to the fact that there in the human soul there lies the possibility for new impulses which can lead to an ascent. But these ascending influences, the existence of these ascending influences which spiritual science points out, is not recorded in this genius book. If there existed only that which is taught in the universities and the schools, that which is published in the newspapers, if only that existed, then Spengler would be quite correct in his calculation that in the year 2200, barbarism would break in over the whole of the Western world. That would be justified. But spiritual science appeals to the will of the human soul, appeals to the inflaming of spiritual forces in the human soul in order to overcome all those external forces which are pushing towards a decline. These external forces must be opposed by new forces which can come out of the human will. And spiritual science alone has the right at the present moment to attack and to push up against such a scientific armor which was presented by Oswald Spengler. And it's laughable to read the criticisms of this book by a person like Benedict Croce. What this book says is perfectly correct, and you have to recognize that. And the only way to meet it is not by saying the book is false, but by finding out where are those impulses which can work against the very truth which exists in the Spengler book. This book of Spengler has had an enormous effect upon thousands and thousands of people. And how do we consider this book? This book, when we try to consider it from the point of view of initiate wisdom, this book explains to us quite clearly the inner construction of the present traditional world conception, the present way of thinking. This book, the Spengler book, shows a remarkable fact that here you can have a genius book, a book written by a genius, and Spengler is extraordinarily a genius person. Nevertheless, this book can say the greatest foolishness, because in this book is also contained great nonsense, but only the sort of nonsense which only a genius man can discover. Ordinary people are not capable to find such great nonsenses as Spengler has found. Now you can appreciate the remarkable effect such a book can have upon people. A book which on the one side has the greatest geniusness which one can admire, at the same time the great foolishness. This has a remarkable effect upon people. These two extremes impinge upon each other in a way which one would never have dreamed about 100 years ago. And when some of these Philistines tried to reproach me and say that I'm calling a person a genius, I'm also calling the fact that he says some very nonsense things, so I'm contradicting myself. That's what they say. What I say is perfectly true. Oswald Spengler is at the same time a genius, at the same time a great fool. Because you have to be a good genius to speak such bloody nonsense as Spengler speaks. The German word is blödsinnig. I translate it bloody. It really means, blödsinnig means imbecile, idiotic, crazy, silly, awful, crazy. You must be a genius like Spengler to think out such blödsinnig nonsense as Spengler thought out. With a lesser degree of cleverness, you couldn't arrive at the fascinating, blinding assertion of Spengler that Prussianism is the real true socialism, that this civilization, which points to its final end and death in the year 2200, has no other way out of its problem than to become completely Prussian, which means to become completely socialist in the Spenglerian sense. And there is a brochure which stands there as a completion by the side of the book The Decline of the West, and this brochure is entitled Prussianism and Socialism. Every side of this book is filled with the most genius approaches to the single detail phenomena of the spiritual and social life. What, for example, Spengler says about the Russianism, that reminds me at times of very much which I myself have spoken about Russianism, about the future of Russianism, about the special configuration of the Russian people. I myself spoke like that. And when Spengler explains that which he said about Russianism, particularly in reference to its scientific justification, he would amplify in his second volume of the book, The Decline of the West. So I must say, I am very happy about that he's going to speak in his second volume about the future of Europe under the influence of the further developing Russianism. Now, from all what I've spoken to you today, you can see the paradox of the whole thing when one really wants to depict that which is actually around us. And one doesn't meet things properly if one doesn't describe in such a paradoxical form that which exists among us. Now, a third thing which one also finds with Oswald Spengler is that he depicts completely a pessimism. Because obviously it's a pessimism if you say that in the year 2200 all of our Western civilization will be succeeded by barbarism. It is particularly a pessimism when one proves with the aid of 12 to 15 sciences, which Spengler is able to do, the fact that in the year 2200 we'll have barbarism. But Spengler, in a certain way, worships with a religious mood this pessimism. He yields himself entirely, I might say, into this pessimism. He glorifies this pessimism, this socialism, or this Prussianism, which will take hold of the whole world. Because only through organization and the permeation of the society in a Prussian sense, even right to the year 2000, would it be possible to defer the necessary decline. All this is really thorough pessimism. The whole of this social Prussianized world which Oswald Spengler has in front of him, this which will still live to the year 2200, this dying Western world, this is, as it were, still glorified by him. He depicts it with an inner fire. But if you examine it exactly, it's not a sustained fire, it's a theatrical fire. I don't like to speak in abstract. I prefer to speak in facts. And if one would ask the reason, why must today a very genius man, insofar as he has a fine observation for certain detailed phenomena of present civilization, how such a person could at the same time be so bloody foolish? Why should a thoroughly clever human being at the same time maintain such complete dumbnesses, dummheiten? Why must such a person who paints pessimism, with a theatrical fire? This pessimism, if you forget that it leads to a decline, if he makes it appear like a grandiose optimism, if he's getting a sort of amazement for this catastrophic decline, you ask the question, why is all that like that? Then I have to answer it with a quite concrete sentence. Oswald Spengler demands, while he thinks completely natural scientific, he demands for the 20th century psychology. But at the same time, he hasn't the slightest inkling of the nature of the human soul. Why? Because in the same moment where he uses the word theosophy, he doesn't know anthroposophy, but when he uses the word theosophy and occultism, when he takes that word in his mouth, then he gets a red head. His head becomes red. He becomes quite fruchtig. Hence, his genius way of looking at things can only dedicate itself only to the shell, not to the inwardness nature. And it's in the inwardness that you have to look for the soul. Hence, his fire is not the sort of fire that proceeds out of the elementary forces of the soul, but his fire, taken in the main, is only a theatrical fire. Oswald Spengler gets a red head when he takes the words theosophy and occultism in his mouth, and he can find no other use for occultism and theosophy than to alf-papple them together with Bolshevism, Spartacism, and a kind of salon socialism. And this again is the grandiose dummheit of such a person whose genius has been born out of the spiritual substance of our present age. And this proves at the same time that there, where there is no inkling of the situation, but where all you get is a redhead, then you can see what the aberration cultural phenomena of our age must produce, even when they come to the fore in a most genius way. This today is something which you consider as an introduction to the most important considerations which I will present to you tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. And here ends the lecture.